Hi. As we head into the final days of the 2020 presidential campaign, many of us are pretty sure this is one for the history books. But that will be for the historians to say, 30, 40, or 100 years from now. On this episode, you may be relieved to know we are not covering the current election, but we are hearing from three great American presidential historians, time travelers, really, who spent their lives submerged in the past so they could report back to the rest of us.
It's science fiction in reverse. I've never written science fiction. But what works in science fiction is, how do people do things? And it's so foreign to us, beginning with space travel of any kind, or with Jules Verne, travel into the interior of the Earth, or whatever. But that's what grabs you about science fiction. They do things differently. Well, the same thing happens in history. How did they do things? How did they measure distance? How did they start a fire when they didn't have any matches and dry newspaper? How did they study the stars when they didn't have the kinds of equipment that we have today? How do you make a canoe when all you've got is an axe and some big trees? How do you do that? So you're traveling in your mind all the time.
That's one of our esteemed guests, Stephen Ambrose, using examples from his book on Meriwether Lewis, Thomas Jefferson, and the opening of the West. His fellow time travelers on this episode are David McCullough and David Herbert Donald. They'll all talk about the presidents who fascinated them most and the art of bringing them to life. This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam May, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
As a young man, David McCullough thought he was going to become a painter, Stephen Ambrose, a doctor, and David Herbert Donald, a high school band director. But then the fascinating long arm of history grabbed each of them by the collar and refused to let go. These three giants of presidential history brought Harry Truman, John Adams, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, Abraham Lincoln, and others to life so we could learn about them and about ourselves as a nation. And they never, ever made it boring. We're going to jump around a little bit between them, but we start now with David McCullough. When he was interviewed by the Academy of Achievement in 1995, he was doing research into Thomas Jefferson and John Adams for his biography of Adams, which would go on to win the Pulitzer Prize.
Two different men who had strikingly different talents, strikingly different emotional makeups. One, Jefferson, was very contained, very restrained, did not want anybody to know what he truly felt, what kinds of passion was within or at odds within, whereas Adams wore his emotions on his sleeve. Adams, who was very eloquent on his feet, a great speaker, a great convincer of juries and delegations at the Continental Congress. Jefferson, who couldn't speak on his feet to save his life, a terrible public speaker, but who could express himself on paper as few people ever have. And how they started off as friends and co-revolutionaries, ultimately became political rivals, even adversaries in a harsh fashion, nearly, who didn't speak to each other for years, who, in a way, were responsible for the political divisions that set up our two-party system, and who then have a great reconciliation after each has served in the presidency and become great friends again, and correspondence, carrying on some of the most eloquent correspondence in our history and in our language, and who then incredibly, unimaginably, die on the same day, and the same day is the 4th of July, 50 years to the day of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, which they created. Now, that doesn't happen in real life. That couldn't happen on the stage or in a movie because nobody would believe it, but it did. And how did the country react to that? It's all part of the story, and it's got me very excited.
You can hear Stephen Ambrose being transported in much the same way as he describes his work to the Academy of Achievement in 1998.
Writing is a monk's life. When I'm heavy into a book, I'll spend 10 hours a day, 10 hours a day. You're all by yourself, you and the cigarettes and the coffee. That's what you do when you're writing. You just sit there, and it all goes through your fingers into that typewriter or computer, and that's all that moves. It's like the monks doing the illuminated manuscripts. The only movement is in your fingers and your wrist. I mean, your body is immobile. But, oh my God, what's happening up here? And I'm with Meriwether Lewis and we're getting into the gates of the Rocky Mountains. Or I'm with Dwight Eisenhower. And the question is, are we going to go or not? God Almighty, who knows what the weather is going to be? We've got this great invasion set to go. I've got to decide now whether we're going to go or we're going to stand down and postpone this thing. And your mind is just...
Stephen Ambrose practically levitated there. And when you listen to David Herbert Donald, you'd think he'd gotten to know old Abe personally when he was writing his best-selling and influential biography called Lincoln. David Herbert Donald was close to 90 when he talked to the Academy in 2007, but he was fully animated with plenty to say about his favorite subject.
Well, Lincoln loved to ride the circuit over many counties all over central Illinois. And often he was away from his wife and his family for weeks at a time. And poor Mary suffered as a result. But he enjoyed meeting people, shaking hands, introducing himself, getting large groups of people to talk to, and he knew everybody by name. But this is the way he made his living. It was very important for him to be able to go into a county that he didn't live in, quickly identify himself, and have young attorneys come up to him and say, I have this kind of case, and I'm not sure about my brief. Would you be co-defendant with me? Now, this gave him, first of all, a very wide constituency. In central Illinois, there was hardly a person who did not know Abraham Lincoln, at least by sight. And in turn, Lincoln had a very wide following of people that he knew. And he had a tenacious memory, so that he would encounter somebody in the streets of Springfield and say, oh, I remember we were at Logan County together, weren't we? And the fellow would say, so proud, Lincoln remembers me. And all of this built up a constituency for him. He understood very well that a public man has to have that kind of following. And he had it as a lawyer. He had it as a state representative. He had it as he ran for the Senate, and especially after he became president.
Beyond the gift of gab, David Herbert Donald went on, Lincoln was also a talented writer and public speaker, which helps explain how he overcame the obstacles of his Western twang and his odd appearance to rise on the national stage. Those were skills he honed as a young lawyer working in a two-man firm with his much more senior partner, a man named Stephen Trigg Logan, who David Herbert Donald also got to know quite well during his many years of research.
Logan, a little wizened, dried-up man who had a hot temper, and he would cross out page after page of nonsense, of legal formalities and so on, to say, this is what we want to say, just these 12 lines, not these 14 pages. And Lincoln watched, and he learned. He learned to gain in succinctness, in clarity, in avoidance of technicalities, so that many of his briefs are really literally short essays, works of art. He carried over the skills that he learned from Stephen Logan to the stump. His early speeches were often, like most early 19th century speeches, full of flowery images and big words and long wind-up. He learned from Logan, forget all that. Get directly to the point and people will listen to you. So he did. And he became a master of direct approach to his audience. They felt he's talking to me personally, not some abstract body out there. Now, this carried over particularly as he became a public figure and as he became president. No other president has equaled Lincoln as a master, a craftsman. When you look over his drafts, you realize how carefully he revised, how thoroughly he looked at words, how he decided on this word versus that one as being the appropriate word, not necessarily any old word. So he was a craftsman and worked at it. He knew that his success depended on his skill with language. This is the more important because in those days, of course, there was no radio, there was no television. How do you reach people? You reach people primarily through some public speaking, but mostly through public documents, which are printed in the newspapers. People read a lot of newspapers in those days. In order to read a story in the newspaper, it's got to be short, it's got to have a structure, it's got to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's got to be logical. One thing has to follow after another. He learned this lesson very early. By the time he became president, his presidential messages are models of what a president ought to be saying.
In person, he was less succinct, but still very much in control.
Lincoln loved to tell stories. He would tell stories at the drop of a hat at all occasions. So it was not something that he did just for show, but he just did it naturally. He was a good storyteller, and he enjoyed his own stories, so that when somebody came to see him, he was often reminded of, that reminds me of a little story. And he would start talking, and then as he went along, his face would light up, usually a rather somber face. His face would light up, he'd show that remarkable set of white teeth and a huge smile and tell the story. And when he got to the punchline, he would often slap his thigh like that, and that's the way it ended. Now, he did that constantly. He told stories often for political reasons, as in the White House, for instance. He insisted on keeping open doors so anybody who wanted to could come into the White House, and they did. And they came in wanting one thing after another. Frequently, people would come in with some great scheme that they wanted. They wanted to interest him in, get him to do so and so. And Lincoln would say, you know, that reminds me of a story that I have out in Indiana when I was growing up. And he would start telling it and would go into great detail about who it was that's telling it and where it was. And he'd slap his thigh like that and get up and say, oh, Mr. So-and-so, it's so nice of you to come see me, pushing him gradually out the door. It was useful for him. Telling stories also was a useful way of avoiding quick answers, easy answers.
David Herbert Donald points out that many presidential candidates over the past century have wanted to connect themselves to the legacy of Lincoln, who was not universally adored during his presidency, but was practically canonized after his assassination.
Some years ago, when I didn't have anything much else to do, I went through a series of newspapers looking at a presidential race to see how often people invoked Abraham Lincoln. The answer was everybody invoked Abraham Lincoln. If you were a racist, you said Lincoln hated the blacks. If you were an equal rights person, Lincoln loved all blacks and tried to give them freedom. If you were a Republican, Lincoln loved the Grand Old Party. If you were a Democrat, Lincoln was at heart really a Democrat. He just ran on a Republican ticket. Everybody loved Abraham Lincoln.
Our current candidates are no exception.
Working people and their kids deserve an opportunity. Lincoln knew this. He said that a country had to give people, and I quote, an open field and a fair chance. An open field and a fair chance. That's what we're going to do in the America we're going to build together.
With the exception of the late, great Abraham Lincoln, I can be more presidential than any president that's ever held this office. That I can tell you. It's real easy.
Now, some legacy to give. It is a legacy of understanding this was a very great leader, and we've had so few in our history. Second, that this was a man of absolute integrity that you could trust whatever he said, and we've had so few people like that in our history. But also, this was a man of peace who wanted to adjust, who did not want to dominate, who did not want to rule like a czar, who did not want to be an emperor of the South. He had modest goals, he kept to them, and I think that's one of the legacies that our president ought to keep from Abraham Lincoln, namely that there are realistic limits on the powers of a president that Abraham Lincoln knew and that we ought to know too.
So how did David Herbert Donald and Stephen Ambrose and David McCullough come to dedicate themselves to mining these presidential stories from the past? For Stephen Ambrose, who we'll turn to now for a bit, the history switch was flipped by a professor named William B. Heseltine.
I started off at the University of Wisconsin as a pre-med, wanting to follow in my father's footsteps. The idea was I'd take up his practice in this little town. And at the second semester of my sophomore year, I was required to take a course in American history, which I didn't want to do. I wanted to get on with physics and chemistry and get into medical school. But the university required me to take it. I sat down in a big lecture course, 300 students. Mr. Heseltine began to lecture. He was talking about George Washington. The course was called Representative Americans. It was biographies. He hadn't been going 10 minutes. And my life had changed. I went up to him at the end of the lecture and said, I want to do what you do for a living. How do I do that? He laughed and he said, well, to start with, you better major in history. I went to the registrar that afternoon and changed my major and never looked back. One of the things that he said that so struck me was that in this course, instead of doing a term paper in which you read three or four books and do some kind of a synthesis of them and just regurgitate knowledge, you're going to be doing original research. And what he had us do was to go to the State Historical Society and go through 19th century documents, letters, diaries, newspapers, about Wisconsin people who were not important enough to have a real biography written about them, but who made an impact. Because he was compiling a dictionary of Wisconsin biography, and we would each write a 10-page biography of this politician, businessman, teacher, whatever, and it would go into this biography series of Wisconsinites. And he said, you're going to be adding to the sum of the world's knowledge. And that just hit me like a sledgehammer. It had never before occurred to me that I could add to the sum of the world's knowledge. Throw me into that briar patch. I went down to the State Historical and got to work on a man named Charles Billinghurst, who was a one-term congressman from Wisconsin, just before the Civil War. And I'll never forget the feeling I had when I finished that work and wrote a 10-page bio of this guy. I know more about Charles A. Billinghurst than anybody else in the world. I just thought that was marvelous. Now, what I soon learned was the reason for that was that nobody else cared about Charles A. Billinghurst. And then what I learned after that was that I can make him care if I tell the story right. And that's how I got into history.
Just like David Herbert Donald, it was the Civil War that most captured the attention of Stephen Ambrose. At first.
Once I'd been exposed to Mr. Heseltine, I was ingesting Civil War books. His Civil War was his specialty, so it naturally became mine. He smoked a big oompah pipe, so I smoked a big oompah pipe, and so on. I mean, hero worship to the extraordinary degree. And all the good books on the Civil War, Bruce Catton's, Douglas Southall Freeman's. I think the book that I learned the most from in terms of technique as a storyteller was Douglas Southall Freeman's biography of Lee, the great biography of Robert E. Lee, because he does this in it. And he tells you in the foreword, this is what he's going to do. You're never going to know anything in this book that Robert E. Lee didn't know. So if we're in the middle of the Civil War at the time of the Battle of Chancellorsville, and Hooker is coming around Lee's flank, and he's going to try to sneak in and make an attack from the rear, and Lee doesn't know that, you're not going to know that as a reader. You're going to find out what Hooker is doing at the moment that Lee finds it out. And what that really means is, in telling a story, don't ever flash forward. Don't ever give your story away. Keep your concentration on the person you're writing about or the event you're writing about. Let things develop chronologically because that's the way it happens in real life. And now that sounds very simple and very easy to do. It's awfully hard to do. Awfully hard to do. The temptation of flashing forward and saying, but he was going to find out how wrong he was about that one, you know. And you give the whole damn story away.
And now, back to David McCullough.
Well, I had many ideas of what I wanted to do. The question was, which one would I do? I thought I would like to be an architect, an actor, a painter, a writer, a lawyer for a while, a politician. I considered going to medical school.
The notion of being an historian came to him a good while into his career and through a side door.
I knew I didn't want to be in business, and I knew that I wanted to get to New York as soon as I could. And when I arrived in New York, I needed a job. And I was fortunate enough to be taken on as a trainee in a brand new magazine that was just starting called Sports Illustrated. And I think now in retrospect that what I did in the next 12 years was to serve a kind of apprenticeship in different jobs, different magazine jobs primarily, editing, writing. And after I'd done that for about 10 or 12 years, I felt that I had reached the point where I could attempt something on my own. But we had many children by then, and I had a good job. And I liked my job. It wasn't that I was rebelling against the imprisonment of a vocation that wasn't for me. I liked the people I worked with. I went in every day very eager to do whatever we had to do. I was an editor then at American Heritage Publishing Company. But I had an idea for a book, and I began working on it at nights and on weekends and on vacations. It took me 3 years. And I had been an English major in college. I had no anticipation that I was going to write history. But I stumbled upon a story that I thought was powerful, exciting, and very worth telling.
That book was called The Johnstown Flood, the story of one of America's most devastating, preventable disasters that killed 2,200 people in a booming coal and steel town in Pennsylvania.
And I taught myself, in effect, how to do the research, how to dig out the pieces, both large and small, of the past. And I discovered in the process that contrary to the notion that the past is a dead thing, that in fact, wherever you scratch the surface, you find life. And it was the life, the people, and what happened to them that was the pull for me. And I had read a lot of history, read a lot of very good writers who had chosen to write history as a kind of other territory, almost like another country.
Who?
Well, Barbara Tuchman, Bruce Catton, all in effect, in a way, what I was, which was a lapsed journalist. That encouragement that one gets, that lift one gets from the books that move you and change your life, books do change your life. I'd read a wonderful account of in an interview with Thornton Wilder, the great playwright, in a collection of interviews done by the Paris Review called Writers at Work. And in that conversation with the interviewer, Thornton Wilder was asked how he got the ideas for his books. and he said, or his plays, and he said, I imagine a story that I would like to read or see done on the stage, and if nobody has written that book or that play, I write it so that I can read it or I can see it on the stage. Well, I wanted to be able to read a really first-rate book about the incredible story behind the disaster at Johnstown in 1889, and I found there was no such book. But having read that interview, I thought, well, maybe you could write the book that you would like to read. And when that book was published, it had a reception, both critically and publicly, with the reading public, that was far beyond what I had expected. And at that point, I decided that I would cut loose and try it on my own. And because I had a wonderful partner, editor-in-chief, wife, who was equally willing to take that risk, biggest risk we ever took, I did it. Had I not had someone in my life who was as willing as I was to take the step, I might not have done it. I am convinced that the only way we ever really learn anything is by doing it. And I found that with my next book, even more so, where I set out to try and understand how the Brooklyn Bridge was built. The engineering, yes, but also the human story, which is very complicated and dramatic and moving. And I had to teach myself the engineering involved. I found the material, the treasure house of letters and diaries that stowed away in an attic that's supposed to be a mythic experience. That happened to me. I found all those letters and diaries of the Roebling family, which were responsible for the bridge, the design of the building of the bridge, in a closet up in the attic of a library in upstate New York, at New York, at the RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And the material was untouched. It hadn't been cataloged, it hadn't been sorted out. Hundreds, thousands of items stuffed away in a big storage closet. And I had to unscramble it all. It was like the ultimate tangled fishing line that I had to slowly put back the way it was meant to be. And then I had to try and understand it. And it took the better part of several years just figuring that out. Now, if I had gone to a lecture, or if I'd been given a textbook, I could have absorbed what was in the lecture, I could have absorbed what was in the textbook, and I could have had it in my head long enough to take the test to pass the course. But probably 6 months, maybe a year, certainly 6 years later, it would be gone out of my head. But it's now been almost 25 years since I did the work on that project, and I could sit down and take a test on all of that and do very well right now, because I had to do it myself. So I think what we must do in education, for example, is to bring the lab techniques used in science to the teaching of the humanities, to the teaching of history and English and journalism and the arts. That's the great thing about the arts. You don't learn to paint except by painting. You don't learn to play the piano except by playing the piano. By the same token, I think you become an historian. I think you become a scholar by being required to do original scholarly work, original detective work of a kind that's involved with doing scholarly research. And once you do that, once you get on that track, you catch the bug and you find out that this is really exciting.
But how did these three historians come to choose the particular presidents they are most famous for writing about? In David Herbert Donald's case, Lincoln.
When I started graduate school, I had no idea that I would wind up studying Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War and such things. I was pretty sure until I graduated from college that I wanted to be a band director. I played the clarinet rather well, I may say, and I certainly had no skills that were marketable. And I didn't know anything about graduate school at all, what you did, except that it would be a substitute for a job. I got to the University of Illinois, where, fortunately for me, the great professor on the American history side was James G. Randall. Professor Randall and his lovely wife, Ruth Randall, took a liking to me, partly, I think, because she was very Southern, and I was very Southern, too, at that time, I guess. And they, in effect, virtually adopted me. I was at their house time after time for dinner, for supper. They took me to plays, they took me to movies. They treated me like an adopted child. And so when the chance came to be his assistant, a graduate assistant, I leaped at it. And even so, I had no idea what I was going to do. I just got it as a job. He was working on his big biography of Abraham Lincoln, Lincoln the President. And he needed somebody to check references and look up books and so on. And so I was doing that. He taught me, I think, in the best possible way. He was not a brilliant lecturer. His courses were fairly pedestrian. I didn't think his seminars were particularly interesting. But working with him on a one-to-one basis as his assistant, I think that's the way one has to learn to be a historian. That is, he was writing, and if he needed some particular reference, I had to go find it and get it. If he was writing, he wanted everything checked meticulously over and over again. So I had to take the manuscript over to the library and check it all out. So that by working closely with him, I got to see, first of all, a lot of the library and its extensive holdings. But I got even more important to understand what a scholar is about. It's about care, it's about painstaking, it's about judgment, as well as about very skillful writing. He was an excellent writer as well. So after a year or so of that, Professor Randall came. I can remember clearly, he's stumping over to my apartment saying, you know, the time's come for you if you've got a thesis subject. And I said, you know, I think that's right, but I don't have anything. Well, he said, you've been working on Abraham Lincoln now for about a year for me, and you've accumulated a lot of information. It'd be a pity for it to go to waste. I suggest that you might want to write a biography of William H. Herndon. Herndon was Lincoln's law partner and biographer. His papers had just become available in the Library of Congress. We had them on microfilm. And he said, with what you already have, you could work on these papers and write a life of Herndon. It would also be about Lincoln. And I thought, yeah, that's an interesting idea to sort of capitalize on what I did know. I worked on it. That was my doctoral dissertation. I was fortunate enough to have it accepted by Alfred Knopp, first round. And they published it in 1948. And that sort of, can you say, trapped me in the Lincoln Civil War field.
The interviewer for the Academy of Achievement asked Mr. Donald whether he thought his Southern roots, he was the son of a cotton farmer, affected his lifelong quest to understand Abe Lincoln, the Civil War, and Reconstruction.
Does it matter that I was a Southerner? Yes, I think it does. In certain senses, I think the fact that I grew up in the South, the Deep South, has contributed to the fact that I am, as you can judge, a nonstop talker and storyteller, and Southerners tend to be. This, I believe, was a help in my early books because, you know, where most people are writing a dissertation like an abstract of a recipe, I sort of spread myself and I told stories and people found it interesting. One of the people, a great professor on my doctoral oral exams, read the dissertation. He said, I see that you're trying in some places to write very well and to reach a large audience. I said, well, yes, I would like to do that. Well, he said, I don't think that's to be encouraged. I have a rule, he says, when I have written anything that I think is clever or witty or striking, I always go through and rub it out. You should do that. And I said, well, maybe that's what I should do. And then he said, you know, after all that, I really enjoyed reading your thesis, and I usually don't. So I thought, well, okay, maybe I'm hitting on something, yeah. So I think Southerners in that sense had something to do with it. Also the fact that I grew up in a half-white, half-black environment. And this has made it a lot easier for me to talk about the South, to talk about race relations, to talk about civil rights, than perhaps some other people who have fixed ideas on these matters.
One of the presidents Stephen Ambrose is best known for writing about is Dwight D. Eisenhower. He wrote several books on Eisenhower, actually. Just as David Herbert Donald went back to the subject of Lincoln and to the Civil War time and time again. But in the case of Ambrose, the history was much newer, and Ambrose was able to do much of his research by spending time with Eisenhower himself.
Well, I was teaching at the University of New Orleans, doing Civil War studies, had published a book called Halleck. He was Lincoln's chief of staff, obscure figure from the Civil War. And it come out of my dissertation that I wrote under Mr. Heseltine. And I got a phone call. It's 1964, and it was Dwight Eisenhower on the phone. And he said, would you be interested in writing my biography? And I said, yes, sir, I sure would. I was 28 years old. I sure would. He said, well, come on up and see me. And I flew up to Gettysburg, and we spent a day talking about what would be involved and access to his papers. And he would tell his friends that, yes, you ought to have Professor Ambrose in for an interview and so on. And a whole day of this. And at the end of the day, he said, well, you must have a lot of questions, young man. And I said, yes, sir, I sure do. But number one is, why me? I mean, there's dozens of Civil War historians out there, older men. He said, I read your book on Halleck. Well, you could have knocked me over. That book was published by LSU Press in 1962 in an edition of 2,000 copies. It sold 931 copies. But one of them was sold to Dwight Eisenhower. And he read it. And he picked me to on the basis of that book. Many, many years later, 1969, well, not that many, 5 years later, And I died, and that I had been with him on a daily basis for a couple of years before that, doing interviews and talking about his life. And Mamie was still alive, and Mamie had the farm at Gettysburg, and then 10 years after that, she died, and I could willed that farm to the government. And it is now part of the whole Gettysburg complex there, belongs to the National Park Service, and is open to the public. And the day after Mamie died, John Eisenhower, the only son, called me and said, Steve, we're getting stuff out of here before it becomes property of the National Park Service. It is very personal to us, me and my kids. And he said, Dad's copy of Halleck is here. And he's got it all marked up. And you want it. And I said, well, what's the alternative? He said, well, the alternative is it's going to stay here where in Dad's bookcase where it was. And I thought for a few seconds. And John said, quick, you got to decide. I got a lot of other people to call here with this sort of thing. And I said, well, John, let's leave it where it is. So it's still there on that Gettysburg farm. And I don't know to this day if I made the right decision or not. But anyway, that's how I got into Eisenhower, is that he called me on the basis of this book that I had written on Henry Halleck.
Ambrose once said that to write of war, you have to walk the battlefields. Well, Gail Eichenthal, who interviewed him for the Academy of Achievement, wanted to know how different it is to write history when you're able to spend time with the living, breathing subject of your story.
It's a funny thing about that. I spent a lot of time with Ike, yeah, really a lot. Hundreds and hundreds of hours talking about his life. Not talking politics, not talking the future, not talking about anything other than his life and the people that he knew and the things that he was involved in. Then I did a biography of Dick Nixon, 3 volumes. I asked Nixon for interview time, and he refused. There's a little story there. He later was asked by Charlie Rose on the television what he thought of my second volume. And Nixon said, I don't read that stuff. And Charlie said, come on, of course you read Ambrose. And Nixon said, he's just another left-wing historian. Well, I love the line, because it's so Nixonian. The one reason I love it is he can call me a left-wing historian if he wants to. I call him names. I can add, however, that Dwight Eisenhower didn't think so. But what I love about the line is that Nixon doesn't just stick the knife in with the left-wing historian business, but he has that twist, just another. And for a man with my ego, oh my God, just another left-wing historian. So to come back to the point, I've never shaken Mr. Nixon's hand. I never had one private moment with him. But I really think that I know him as well as I do Dwight Eisenhower, with whom I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours. I never met Meriwether Lewis, but I feel like I know Meriwether Lewis better than I know my brothers. So there are various ways that you get to know people. And I don't know which one is best. You just work with what you've got. When Nixon refused to see me, I just thought, well, all right, I'm just going to have to work harder and interview more people that were with Nixon at various times in his terribly long career. Nixon, the funniest thing, Nixon was 5 times nominated for national office. He won 4 of those elections. And the 5th, 1960, against Jack Kennedy, we'll never know who really won that election. Kennedy was declared winner. So this is Nixon's life. And do you know he's a man who felt that life cheated him? Isn't that remarkable? Eisenhower had little sayings that he liked, such as, all generalizations are false, including this one. And he liked to use those kind of things. One of them was, never question another man's motives. His wisdom, yes, but not his motives. Dick Nixon was just the opposite. He always questioned the other guy's motives and always figured that they were base. And of course, Nixon's motives were very often base. So they were very different, Ike and Dick. Eisenhower had a great love of life and a love for people. It was Eisenhower's most obvious characteristic. And Nixon just, the damnedest thing for a politician, which is the business of being gregarious, of backslapping, of being friendly. And Nixon hated it, and hated that part of being a politician.
Stephen Ambrose originally had absolutely no interest in writing about Nixon when his very famous editor, Alice Mayhew, pushed him into doing it. Mayhew, who just recently passed away, was, in Ambrose's words, the 95-pound terror of the publishing world and a hard person to say no to.
And she said, where else are you going to find a bigger challenge than to do a good job on the life of a man that you don't like or even approve of? Well, she caught me with that. She caught me with that just as effectively as Mr. Heseltine caught me with you're going to make a contribution to the world's knowledge. And I thought, all right, Alice, I'll show you. I'll go out and do a book on Nixon that is not stabbing him in the back and not putting him on a pedestal, but is attempting to get at his character, which is virtually impossible. I think it got to be Shakespeare to get at Dick Nixon's character. But as Samuel Johnson says, which my favorite line of advice for a biographer, we cannot look into the hearts of men, but their actions are open to observation. So 3 volumes later, 800 pages per volume, so that's what, 2,400 pages on Dick Nixon, I think I accomplished my goal, which was to write a book about Nixon that was fair and honest and praised him where he deserved to be praised and damned him where he needed to be damned, and that came out to reviews that centered on the objectivity of the author. So I'm very proud and pleased about that aspect of it. I ended up having a great deal of admiration for Nixon. I never did learn to like him, but he never wanted to be liked anyway. He wanted to be followed. He wanted to be powerful. He didn't care if he was loved. People that don't love don't care if they're loved or not. Ike always wanted to be loved. That was another big difference between the two of them.
Stephen Ambrose said he learned more than he could have ever imagined during the many years he spent researching Nixon. He, Ambrose, had leaned pretty far to the left as a young historian, but he found himself intrigued as he talked to every prominent Republican in the country about Nixon. He liked and respected some of these people, and he wanted to know what they saw in Nixon that he did not. And that open mind, that curiosity, he says, allowed him to write a 3-volume history that was fair and was interesting.
Curiosity. Curiosity is essential. You've got to have a burning curiosity to find out how did Lewis and Clark do that. If you don't have that curiosity, find another way to make a living. You're never going to make it as a writer. Because if you're curious and then you find the answer, then you want to share it. And you want to tell that story. And you want to say to the world, listen, come here. Sit down around this campfire. I want to tell you a story. I want to tell you about this kid from Whittier, California, who was about as obnoxious a kid as you'd ever imagine, that nobody wanted to be around. Nobody, and he went on to be president of the United States, winning 2 elections. How did he do that? Now I'm going to tell you how he did it.
And as David Herbert Donald pointed out, there is nothing quite like getting to tell stories from American history.
American history is exciting, first of all. We're really the only modern nation whose entire career, entire history, is available to us. And we go from the very first papers about the settlement in Jamestown all the way down to the present. And the documents are there. There are no mysteries about it. If you were writing about the history of England or Sweden or so on, you'd have to go back to the depth of time and still wouldn't know how did things begin. So in America, you have a kind of case study of the development of a nation and how it grew and why it grew and why it grew in this particular way. And this has always had a special fascination for me.
David McCullough will have the last word here about how American history for him as a writer has all the drama he always loved in literature, in theater, and in the movies, and how they inspire him still to tell stories that matter.
I don't think you can underestimate the impact of the movies on my generation. The movies were how we saw the world. When I said earlier I couldn't wait to go to New York, it was because the way New York was portrayed in the movies. You could do anything, be anything. And the heroes of those movies, very important to understand that. And Jimmy Stewart. I think if I were to ask who most influenced me, maybe it was Jimmy Stewart. The parts he played, he's almost always playing the same part, and that is the seemingly ordinary, decent American who, when put to the test in an extreme situation, rises to the occasion and does the extraordinary. And that's an old, old story in our American way of life. In fact, it's the story of Harry Truman, which is what I've spent the largest part of my creative writing life working on, a project of 10 years. That's the story of Harry Truman, the seemingly ordinary fellow who put to the test, rises to the occasion, and does the extraordinary. And I think we like that story because that's the story of our country. We had the founding fathers who set this very idealistic, lofty, aspiring set of rules and guidelines and design for the ultimate culture, civilization, way of life we were going to create here. And then they leave the stage. Can we live up to the promise of their concept? And that's the story of the Brooklyn Bridge. The father has the dream of this extraordinary bridge, this unprecedented bridge. He is killed. He dies at the very beginning. His son has to take over. Can he carry out the father's exceptional, idealistic conception? Those early founders of our country, in a way, set the bar, if you've ever been a high jumper, set the bar very high. Can we, are we, up to jumping that high?
That's David McCullough talking to the Academy of Achievement in 1995. His most recent book, published in May of 2020, is called Pioneers. It tells the very American story of the courageous men and women who overcame severe obstacles to settle the Northwest Territory. Mr. McCullough divides his time between Massachusetts and Maine, and at 87, still enjoys painting. He is a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award, and was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President George W. Bush. David Herbert Donald was interviewed in 2000. He was also a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. His final book was We Are Lincoln Men, Abraham Lincoln and His Friends. Mr. Donald passed away in 2009 at the age of 89. And Stephen Ambrose was interviewed in 1998. He passed away in 2002. His final book was called This Vast Land, a fictionalized account of the Lewis and Clark expedition written for children. For more fascinating insights into presidential history, by all means listen to our episode about historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. Happy voting, people. What It Takes is made possible with generous funding from the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.